Well, actually, it seems like my little finger told me you were working on a book. So I
Yes.
thought we could discuss this a little bit.
Right. Okay. How shall we attack this? What's the first question?
Well, actually, that's probably as I will not be speaking for the audience out there, but as far as I was concerned until recently, at least, I would tend to associate the work of the Hafner Trio to some sonic sound related work, let's say. So the book thing and the written words, I was quite surprised actually. So maybe we could start by, maybe you could explain how much the work of the Hafner Trio relies actually on the written words.
Okay, well, I mean, I don't think I can give you a percentage, but right from the very beginning, there was always more than just sound matter included in any of the releases. I mean, right to the very beginning, there was a lot of notes, a lot of pointers and commentaries, and all adding to confusion on one level or another. And there isn't really any of them which don't have this. So it was always a dimension, and it might have seemed at times that it was just like a sort of a caption underneath a photograph, serving that sort of function. But actually, the sound itself is only a means to actually put forward certain ideas anyway. So all of it is meant to do certain things. And very often, with the way that people, as well, I mean, even especially today, where people don't read as much or as carefully as they used to, I think, you couldn't pull them apart. If you did pull them apart, it would be like taking away a large part of it, where it wouldn't make much sense anymore. And the first record, Bang, for example, doesn't make much sense if you don't have the sleeve notes about Robert Spridgin, about all of these other kinds of things. If you take 7 hours sleep, the quote unquote story that goes with it, that actually tells you how to listen to the record, and so on and so forth. So it's an integral part, and it always has been. Some more than others, but I mean, very quickly there was a large amount of text material, and it's one of the arguments that I always give about putting stuff on the internet, is that you are divorcing a large constituent part of the project if you just have an MP3 of the CD or something like that. You're missing an enormous amount. It would be like looking at a painting, but you're only looking at the greens or the blues, which, of course, if the picture is just blue, that's okay, but that's all right, but in the case of some other people, it wouldn't be. So it's always been extremely important, yes. But to do it just by itself, I mean, when I was a teenager, I did all sorts of writing experiments. I was inspired by, some of the usual suspects, the Burroughs and Beckett and Joyce, and all these people who tried to actually do something different in writing. We can call it experimental, but I mean, everything is experimental in that sense. You never really know how it's going to turn out. So, of course, you learn by copying those people, and I did write a whole bunch of things, which deserve not to be published ever. But that's the stuff that you do when you're practicing. It's like when you're practicing an instrument, you go outside to the woodshed and you make all the horrible noises before you show in public. Well, these days, of course, that's the opposite of what happens. Everybody learns in public. So I think, as far as I'm concerned, the way that people not only appreciate, and I mean appreciate in the sense of sort of take on board A certain idea has changed a lot in terms of writing, because the way that we have the relationship that we have with the written word has changed quite a lot in the last 20 or 30 years, I would say. Yes. So, I also used to have a thing where I unconsciously, and then I met Willem de Ridder and he put it into words, is I never wrote anything unless I knew it was going to be published. So I didn't just sort of, apart from when I was a teenager, I didn't sort of sit there and sort of satisfy my own curiosity by writing. If somebody asked me to write something, or if it was in one case, one quite famous case with Psychic TV, it was a written piece which ended up on the back of one of their records. You know, if someone was doing a compilation, and there were quite a few in the 80s of written compilations, you know, anthologies, we can say, of different people, mainly sound people, but other artists. And there were many publications which were anthologies, collections of different people with short texts. And so I would occasionally write for one of those. and that sort of thing. Now, after a while, these things start to accumulate and they take on a sort of life of their own if they're not, like I gave you in the first instance, they're not married to a project like a record or something, if they're just these loose things. And so at a certain point, I don't identify myself as a writer. I don't identify myself as an artist. I don't identify myself as a musician. I don't have any of these things. So it's all the same to me, in the sense that it's trying to create a situation where something can happen. And that's different for every single situation. So does that help at all?
It helps a lot. Maybe just pushing a little bit further, because on the book itself as a medium, I remember you told me that you started very early, at an early age, to you spent a lot of time in the library.
Oh, yeah.
Reading books from one part of the bookshelf to the other.
Right.
And I guess book as a medium to get information and then knowledge, it has a special special place for you. And I was wondering if in the other sense, I mean, in the sense of transmitting, it is as strong a medium as it has been for you to get knowledge, if that makes sense to for you.
Right. Yeah, well, of course, there's an enormous number of factors, not just about my attitude to it, but also it's easier to publish a book today than it has ever been. For example, you can have what they call vanity publishing, where you can have print on demand, and you don't need to, you know, have these hundreds of copies sitting around doing nothing for years and years and years. The ease with which you can do these things in terms of designing them, of course. You know, in the old days, you used to have to go to a typesetter, who was a person who would actually input all the text and make sure that it actually printed out correctly. And that was a highly specialized job, which I think is probably dead by now. I don't think anybody just does typesetting full time, although typesetting is an art and is largely lost. I mean, there are all sorts of psychological impacts that certain kinds of spacing of letters, or indeed paragraphs, page layouts and all the rest of it have on the reader. So you can get a very different effect and a very different kind of comprehension by styling a particular text in a particular letter type or arrangement on a page, or you know, all these kind of things. These are things which people just don't, not many people think about anymore. It's so easy to do. In the old days, of course, it was pretty much impossible to do all that yourself. So that has changed. The other thing which has changed is that, of course, you have now electronic books, which, of course, I think they've done some research on this, and most people never finish them. So there are people who have a lot of these things on their hard drives, and they will open them and they will they won't even read the contents page. They'll read the first couple of pages, and then they say, oh, yeah, I'll come back to that later. And they never do. A bit like the sort of phenomenon with bookmarks in browsers, where people put things aside for later and they never come back to it. I don't think I know anybody who ever goes back to their bookmarks and reinvestigates these things. I mean, what we've also lost is this idea when we read on a screen of the physical, not only contact, but the physical relationship to what we are reading. We hold a book at a certain length and we can move that, whereas with the screen, we basically move ourselves. So that kind of, there's a subtle psychological relationship there. Who's in control? Who's actually in control of the text? Is it the reader, or is it the person who wrote the thing? So, or is it actually the medium of transmission itself? You know, these are all very, very complex questions to go into. And that's one of the things which, of course, you have to be subliminally, if not consciously, dealing with if you're going to be putting anything out in book format today. Because, picking up a book from a book which was published, let's say, 100 years ago, you would even the most inexperienced person is going to look at that in a very different way. There's a kind of an intent which is lost when something becomes extremely easy. I mean, if it takes, just a few minutes to put together some kind of audio thing and upload it to the internet, this is not quite the same as when you know that this person had to sit and write this, and it took them 3 years or something, or whatever. Even if that's not important, which a lot of people would say it isn't, there's a definite difference in the feeling which it comes across. So even if people disagree with that the whole idea that intention can be felt, you can definitely see that there's, if you just literally, give these things to people and tell them to look at it, you can tell immediately if somebody's taken care with something or whether they've just banged it out. You know, that's always been true, and I think it always will be. So even on that level, I think it's important that, let's say, quality things still get put out into the swimming pool. Basically, they raise the temperature very slightly, and that benefits everybody. There's a great deal to be said of being able to publish immediately, being able to write a web page and instantly millions of people can see it. Of course, that was one of the huge problems of publishing, was distribution, is the people who wanted it couldn't get it. If we're talking about, for example, something like Grove Press, who published Burroughs and Henry Miller and James Joyce and all sorts of things. This Maurice Girodias took a huge risk in putting these things out. And people used to go from England to France, and there was a small bookshop in Calais where they could buy these forbidden books, and then they would get straight back on the boat and go back to England. You can read the accounts of when the beat writers came from America, and the first thing they did when they arrived in France was to get these forbidden books. It's the old story. If you make something difficult to get, then people want it more. So, right. And these weren't just, sort of difficult to get. These had been banned. Let's not forget, these things had been banned in certain countries, and you literally could not read them. And Girodas, Grove Press publisher, he, you can read scandalous stories about how he never paid anybody and all the rest of it. But the point is that he did actually, especially in the case of Burroughs and, a couple of other people, he fought these legal battles. Like, for example, he had to go to court in every single state in America to fight for the publication of certain books. Now, that cost a fortune. That cost an absolute fortune to fight this in every single state in America, and he did it. So you can definitely say that this man was an incredibly important thing, because I remember Allen Ginsberg saying that in the 50s, one of the terrible things was not censorship from the government, or from, you know, anything like that. It's that you would sit down at the typewriter and there's certain words you wouldn't even type. You would simply not even type those words because you realize they would never get published. And he said that kind of censorship is the worst, because you're actually self-censoring. And it's become such a bad, you know, it's become so difficult that you even won't write certain things. Now, obviously, that's a state of affairs which has changed completely as well. I mean, there's almost nothing. There's a couple of things that you wouldn't publish, but pretty much anything you care to put onto paper or onto electronic paper, you can get it out there, you know. So that has. So part of the worth and part of the excitement and part of the value of the printed book is that, of course, they were very special things. It wasn't something that anybody could do. You know, it was very few people could actually do this. Just like records, you know, making a record was a big thing. I mean, you only have to look at the history of, you know, famous pop groups and, you know, getting the record contract and getting the first vinyl copy of their work, you know, was such an incredibly exciting thing. I mean, I don't think anybody gets really excited about, oh yeah, there's a new MP3 of my work out on the internet, you know. I don't think anybody gets that. I don't think there's that kind of, you know, buzz anymore. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm just saying that it's different, basically.
Different, yeah. It's totally different.
So, one of the things that, of course, which is also the same as the first records that I listened to, or the first books that I read, were this. There was this idea that it was much more than just a product. It wasn't just entertainment, and it wasn't just information, and it wasn't just. It was an experience which changed you. That you were not the same person after you had read this book or listened to this record or saw this painting or saw this film. You were not the same person as you had been before. You couldn't go on in the same way as you had been because you had seen something or heard something or experienced something which changed you fundamentally. Not just a temporary change, but something which deeply shifted some part of yourself at a very, very, you know, basic level. And I always wanted with, you know, greater degrees of success in some cases than in other cases, but to actually do that so that other people would have those kind of transformative experiences. Again, that's not to put entertainment down. It's just, I was never particularly interested in it. Mm-hmm. So when I did the writing, it did end up being very, very dense, and you needed to put a lot of work into it to get out the meaning that was in there. To get the experience, you had to work almost as hard as I had to work as to, you know, to write the damn thing. And the same is true of the records, and the same is true of, you know, of all these things. They're not, it's not easy listening and it's not easy reading. And many times it's come up and saying, well, why don't you write a good story? You know, just the same as people say, well, why don't you make a popular record? And I mean, the easy answer is I can't. But the other answer is, well, what, you know, does the world really need another one of these things? I think there's plenty of people who do that very, very well. I don't even feel any kind of pull towards even trying to do that. It needs to be something which I can. I want to walk away from these things, or I want to put this book down, or I want to, you know, having finished listening to this piece of music or this record or whatever it has to be. I mean, I want to be speechless. I want to be, you know, I want to be sort of, my God, what on earth just happened? You know, that's really what I want from these things. Now, to do that, you have to use various tricks or techniques or whatever to get the audience to go into this because they're not used to it. The majority, there are some people who seek out the difficult in life, but most of the things that you will get to read or to hear don't take that much effort to unpack. Now, in order to get people to do that, you have to either seduce them, threaten them, trick them, confuse them. You know, there's many, many different ways to do it. And I've used pretty much all of them at some point or other. So you've got to, it no longer becomes, you know, the poet in the attic with the bottle of wine, you know, I must write a poem. It's not that anymore. It becomes a question of actually seeking to create something which is going to affect people. And to do that, you have to understand basic psychology and some advanced psychology, and you have to test this, and you have to be prepared to fail as well, because it won't work for everybody. But you're no longer doing it as a solitary exercise. You're actually doing it with the idea that this is going to be read by somebody else, and that it does actually matter, and that actually if nobody else reads it, then it won't have succeeded at all. So this is very often the case with, you know, the great writers who had to write. And, you know, all these great painters who had to paint, and, you know, they die and we find out that there are hundreds of paintings we didn't even know. They just had to do it, and there was no stopping them. And there was no, you know, they even if nobody had read their work or seen it or whatever, they didn't care. I mean, Kafka famously told this Max Brod, I think his name was, that he wanted all of his manuscripts destroyed.
Yeah, destroyed.
He died. And Mr. Brod decided not to do that, and now we have Kafka's books. Otherwise, we wouldn't even have them.
Yeah.
So this whole compulsion to create, whether anybody else sees it or not, is held up to be a kind of a noble thing. You know, this person was, you know, they didn't care. But at a certain point, I think it's also equally valid to say that actually, if nobody else reads this, then it's not worth anything at all. Because what I'm interested in doing is actually creating that experience for other people. It's a kind of a service, if you like, to other people. It's not me trying to get them to read my book or listen to my record so that I'll have lots of money. Because if that was my motivation, believe me, I would have made them in a very, very different ways. So it's a necessary thing to consider that it will be read, and that person will not be you, and that person will not know the things that you know or have the experiences that you've had. So you have to create. So as you're reading these texts or listening to these records or whatever, a world is being created by the act of it being read or listened to. By the act of it being experienced, a new world of sorts comes into being. And that you can't do as a solitary exercise. Or you can do it for yourself, obviously. But the idea that a stranger will actually be able to enter into that world, all sorts of other things become possible because of that. So another long answer, but does that answer it, or does that make it
easier? Oh yeah, definitely.
Okay,
but it triggers as well other question though, and probably just if you allow me to just ask just one, it's like then how it's clear now that the link with the Hafner trio, but how do you use, like, for instance, you will decide, okay, for this type of effects I want to create, for instance, I think sound is more appropriate, and for those others I think it's better to have it written down somewhere in a booklet or a book. Is this how you proceed, that you kind of separate? And so that
not,
the medium
not really not really. I mean, I think there was one occasion when I did that, but mainly it sort of dictated itself. I think the sounds came along, something would have suggested it. With the writing, for most part, as I said, you know, people would ask me to do it. They would say, you know, can you write something for my magazine, or you know, whatever. Or a record was planned, and in actually quite a few cases, I had the title before I had anything else. And I started actually writing down notes. And the way I write notes is actually pretty close to actually how the written texts come out as anyway. So it's just a natural extension. I mean, there's never really been a conscious decision to separate these things out. And now I'm writing, and now I'm doing this. It was never like that. It was a very organic process, and it all just sort of, I need to write this down at this point, or it was just more suitable to write this down than it was to create some, I don't know, sonic version of that idea or something like that. Again, you know, it's a sort of an in-between world. It's not one thing and it's not the other. So in the case of the longest text, which was this, just because a cat has a kittens in the oven doesn't make the biscuits, this was actually commissioned. Yep. There was Temple Press, what used to be called Temple Press, and this was an offshoot of the Temple of Psychic Youth, which was the sort of occult wing of psychic television. And in Brighton, there were a bunch of dedicated individuals who were publishing, basically esoteric texts. And one of the early ones was a paperback book, and there were longish texts by myself, by Genesis Peorage, and by Zev. And this was Ratio 3, Transmediate. And I was basically asked, because at that point we were all friendly, and this was a period where Psychic TV were undergoing a sort of a sea change, and they were just about to start basically doing the sort of more commercial things, the more sort of house things. But they were in a sort of a transition period, and Zev, being the sort of the occult expert that he was, he had known Genesis for a very long time, and they hadn't really done anything together, but they knew each other, and there was this occult interest. And I'd known Genesis. I'd never been an official member of the group, except I'd done one tour with them, and I'd worked very closely with Zev. So it was a sort of a natural thing to get the three of us together. And actually, taken as a whole, it was. But I didn't know what they'd written. So it's not like I knew what they were writing, or indeed that they knew what I was writing. So it wasn't planned in that sense. The whole thing wasn't about anything in particular. So it was this quite interesting thing where it wasn't, 20 different people, as there were many, just in the same way as there were many compilation records in the 80s and 90s, where there would be one short track by 20 different people. It was three people. So there was an extended, it was a chance to do something a bit extended. So I started writing this thing. And we had a certain number of, I can't remember how he limited. I think we were told a certain number of words, maybe. I think that was the only stipulation. And I thought, okay, well, let's do this. Like, I'd already been experimenting with this idea of writing things that as if they were sort of scenes in a play or something like that. So you would, instead of separating things by chapters, you would separate them out as like sort of sections. So it wasn't seen, it wasn't supposed to be that you would take these things as being a story. These were just sort of, you could start to see that there were relationships, but they were like, the closest example I can give you was, I once helped in England. I helped somebody change over, do some building work in a house which had been what in English you call a chemist, but in other countries you call it, where you can, in the old days you used to be able to buy medicines and an apotheke, a pharmacy. In England you used to call them chemists. Anyway, because these people actually had access to this stuff, they were the people who used to develop film. So you would take with your old-fashioned camera, you would take your 24 photographs or whatever it was, and then the reel would be finished, and then you would take it to them, and they would develop the photographs in the back. That was actually how they did. And when I was refurbishing this place, there was a few boxes of these photographs which nobody picked up. So there must have been a few hundred of these pictures, that just abandoned pictures. And they were fascinating because you had no context. You had absolutely no context for these things. You didn't know the people. You didn't know why they would take photographs. And some of them were extremely bizarre. I mean, extremely, wow. The things that people take photographs of in those days, especially when, you know, it cost money. It wasn't like a digital thing where you can take as many as you like and it doesn't cost you anything. You know, each photograph, you had to think about it, and because it was going to cost you money to have it printed. So that's the closest I can give you as in a sort of a metaphor or a simile for what I was trying to do. So that it's you have to piece it together yourself in a way. And there is, I mean, as you can probably understand, I mean, there is a sort of a method underneath all the madness. But at first glance, you could actually put them in pretty much any order if you wanted. Now, obviously, that's only a suggestion because a book is printed in a certain order and you don't normally rip out the pages and start reading them in a random order. So the suggestion is there. So they're sort of independent. You could actually take them independently. But if you choose to, you can start to make the bridges, the sort of internal connections, and you will see that there's a totally different thing underneath it. So it ended up being 31 sections. And it was published, and I think a lot of people were kind of surprised by the fact that Zev was very much an outsider. People had maybe heard of him. Oh, it's that guy that hits metal. And so people were surprised that that was in there. And they were surprised that Genesis had written such a long piece himself. And then who the hell was I? So there was quite a bit of that as well. Now, it was dealing with things, many different things, many different things, which were of that time and also sort of universal. And then recently it became quite obvious that some things are quite, you know, they have a shelf life, like a carton of milk. It will have a date on it, and after that date, it's no use. There are certain records like that. There are certain books like that. And there are some which last longer than others. And there are some which cry out to be reinvestigated. And this was one of them. So that's what I started to do. And what it's given me an opportunity to do is to expand this idea. I mean, I wrote the first version of it in a couple of weeks. And my life today is extremely different, and it's 30 years ago, pretty much. So obviously, pretty much everything is different. So by re-examining this and commenting on it, it gives me a chance to explore this whole possibility, which of course is also not a usual thing, that you get to reinvestigate your own mental processes from 30 years ago. And there is a universality to that as well. It's like this idea that we are, there's a whole bunch of things packed into that. I mean, one of the things is you're always supposed to keep the same attitude. You know, very often people will say, but you said in an interview in 1981 that blah, 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 blah. Well, no, of course I don't believe that anymore. Thank God for that, you know. But you're expected to. You see this many times, not just with artists, but also politicians and stuff like this, is that they're always supposed to say the same. You say something once, and it's always supposed to be what you believe. You're not allowed to change. You're not allowed to change your mind. You're not allowed to. And if you do, it's like some sort of confession. It's like, yes, I was wrong. And, you know, now I publicly confess my, you know, blah, 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 blah. And it's bizarre. So this is an opportunity to show that kind of process where you can even laugh hysterically at the idiocy that you actually wrote down 30 years ago. But you can also show how that is part of our culture, is that you are expected to always be the same person. I mean, you might have had this experience, and many of the people who will hear this will have the experience where somebody will say, you're not the person I met 3 years ago.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, thank heavens for that, you know. So, you're always supposed to stay the same, you know. And that fluidity, of course, brings into question, well, who is anybody anyway? And that's an extremely important question. And, you know, everybody has to ask themselves that question at some point in their lives. And some people make a habit of it, and some people make it their career. but identity, this whole notion of identity becomes very, very, very clear. It's, I don't know if you ever had the experience of reading a diary from 30 years ago or even 10 years ago. And first of all, you can't read your own writing. And then the second the second thing is, of course, you go, I don't remember that. You know, like, did I really do that? You know, and if you were shown film of yourself, and of course, that's becoming increasingly possible. But I mean, if you were to see film of yourself from 30 years ago, I'm sure you wouldn't recognize yourself, you know?
Yeah. But let's have a little pause here, because you just mentioned the title of it, right?
Right.
And I think we could you could give us a little bit of clues about what the title is. So you said, just because a cat has a kittens in the oven doesn't make them biscuits.
Right. Well, when I first saw this phrase, I mean, I just thought it was one of the great surrealist phrases of our time. So, I mean, it's I've made a, you know, I've not a conscious, but I mean, I've definitely collected many, many of these immortal phrases. I have actually heard it a few other times in recent years. I actually have come across people saying it, but at that time, it was just came out of nowhere. But the idea is, of course, that just because something appears one way doesn't mean to say that it's that way. So, the idea of cause and effect, the idea that A leads to B, the idea—it's an outmoded idea, and other philosophies and systems have shown this to be that causality is only a part of the picture, and that there are an infinite number of causes to every single event, and there's an infinite number of effects. And just because it looks one way doesn't mean to say that it will actually be that way. And again, this is a personal observation, which you get to see if you see a part of yourself from a long time ago, is that just because you thought it was that way at that time, and today you go, well, of course it's not like that. Because you see things in a completely different perspective. And this is a very, very important thing. Whenever I'm having some sort of heated discussion with someone, very often, if it's in person, I will say, well, were you ever wrong about anything? And of course, everybody will say, well, of course, yes, yes, yes. And I say, well, yeah, but did you know at the time that you were wrong? And the answer just has to be, well, no, of course you didn't know. So just because you think something is one way, and you may be absolutely convinced, you may be 100% certain that something is one way, time will show you that it isn't necessarily that way. So yeah. This goes very deep. If you can hold that attitude, then pretty much everything changes. You don't go along with 100% certainty. And in fact, it may be a cliche, but it is true that, or I have found it to be true, that if you're 100% certain about something, you're almost definitely wrong. So this crazy idea that you can be 100% right about something, and there will never be any exceptions to that, I think modern life, if it shows you anything at all, it will be that. The unpredictability, you know, of major events that nobody sees coming. And we have, you know, in recent memory, I mean, just in the first couple of months of this year, and the last month of the last year, I mean, all sorts of things that have happened that nobody predicted. And and of course, we use logic and we say, yeah, well, we could have worked that out, you know, but we don't, you know. And then what's even worse is that we also start to believe that just because it's happened means it's more likely to happen again. Well, actually, it's less likely. Unexpected things which happen once are less likely to happen again. And so we then close doors and make security things, and we plan for these unexpected events to happen. And guess what? More unexpected things happen that we didn't predict. So we are spectacularly bad as a species of predicting things that we can't predict. Spectacularly bad. So all of this is actually, you know, revealed to me in this title. It actually has all of this. And it's also a very good example of expressing an idea in very visual terms. you can see it. You know, it's a very memorable. It's not because it's a great title. It's just a very colorful phrase, and it makes it so that you remember that concept very well, I think. So that's, you know, this is one of the great things about the surrealism of some folk wisdom, which is really what that comes from. I mean, it's just, you know, there are so many ridiculous phrases around. And if you actually, you know, they're part of the air you breathe. In all languages, you have these bizarre, and as soon as you're asked to translate them, you suddenly say, well, this is an extremely strange thing to say. Why do people say this? You know, and you hadn't thought about it until you're asked to actually see it through someone else's eyes, which is, of course, what translation is all about. Yeah. So then, of course, the possibility is even richer, because then you're getting to see it in a very different perspective when you take it from one language into another, because a lot of the ways of expressing things, which you might even think are universal, are extremely localized. And what's also amazing is to find out what is general and what is local. And you're very, I know for myself, I mean, I'm very surprised at just what can be translated and what can't be. And I mean, this is more and more as I get older, this the subject of translation becomes ever more important. And in fact, it's probably one of the most important things today, I would say. I think it's always been very important. And there is a kind of danger in, with the technological advances that are being made, there's a very great danger that people think that translation is just simply a question of algorithms. And that, you know, basically translation is more or less a list of words down one side and a list of words down the other side of the paper, and this one equals this one and this one equals this one. And as soon as you get out of the especially the sort of romance languages, French, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, as soon as you get out of that and you get into, let's say, Asian languages, you find that it just does not work like that at all. Mm-hmm. It can work, I mean, but even within the romance languages, there are extreme difficulties of expressing things which we take for granted in, you know, if we only know those languages. But in the Asian languages, I mean, especially something like Tibetan or Sanskrit or even Chinese, there are certain concepts which are impossible. I mean, just literally impossible. And the temptation to cut corners is horrible. I mean, then you start to realize, and you know, most of my adult life, I've read a great deal which has been translated. And then you start to go, well, okay, if it's that difficult, I wonder if I can really trust this translation. I wonder if this, and then you start to investigate things which are of monumental importance, like, for example, mistranslations of the Bible. Yeah. We're not talking here about a sort of difference of opinion. We're talking about ways that people actually lead their lives because they take this book to be a way to live your life. You know, these are instructions on, and if those instructions and those things are mistranslated, then those people have been living in a way which would probably appall them if they were to actually find out. And I've always been interested in such things. And the more I realize just how a translator who is not impartial, and that's very hard to be impartial, is an enormous, has the responsibility, is absolutely gigantic. I mean, it's fascinating, but it's also terrifying. I give you one example. Years ago, when the first sort of real story of Mao Zedong came out, it was revealed for the first time that the Chinese had all the materials to make the atomic bomb, but to make the atomic bomb required the assistance of the Russians, who had built such things. But there was it was impossible to translate a lot of the technical requirements from Russian into Chinese, and it never got built. So Mao Zedong was told that if he used such a bomb, it would probably wipe out 2/3 of the population of China and a great deal of the world. And he said, fine, that's fine. He didn't care. So if they had had this bomb, they would have actually used it. And the only reason it wasn't is because there was no possible, nobody could translate the physics and mathematics and all the rest of it, which was necessary to build the atomic bomb, from Russian into Chinese. So now you start to see that it's extremely important, especially if we're talking about things that affect millions and millions of people. If there's even a comma in the wrong place, this can alter the meaning of a sentence to an enormous extent. You know, I mean, not just a little bit, but, you know, the complete opposite of what was actually meant. And half jokingly, half seriously, I think a lot of tone in translation affects the way that people react. If we're talking about what we used to call the Cold War between Russia and, you know, the rest of the world, a lot of the translators, as I now understand, fell victim to the habit that Russians have when they translate from Russian into English of following the exact structure of Russian, but just literally translating word for word. Now, this you end up with a situation where when you say in Russian, very often you say the word for please, you put this at the end of the sentence, which is пожалуйста. So if you were to say, you know, дайте мне немного денег, пожалуйста. So that's, they would literally translate that as, give me some money, please. Now, if you say that to someone in English, it sounds like a command. So give me some money, please. By the end of the sentence, the American or the English person has not heard the last part, which says please. They're in shock because this Russian person has commanded them to give them some money. In English, you would very often say, please, could you give me some money?
Yeah.
You put the polite bit at the start. So if you are to follow these kind of ways of translating, of course, that's how the reputation that the Russians have for being very aggressive, for being very rude. That's how these kind of things get started, which has literally to do with bad translation. So rather than it just being a sort of philosophical thing, this has real world impacts. This has really very, very strong impacts on how people see things. Now you also, if we talk about religious texts, for example, we have to understand that a large part of Eastern texts were translated by people who'd grown up in a very heavily Christian environment. So when they're trying to translate certain concepts, they automatically default to the language that would be familiar to them. Mm-hmm. So you would have a situation, for example, like in Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths are that there is suffering. That's the first noble truth, is that the Buddha said that there is suffering, the fact of suffering. And then we have the rest of the noble truths are basically the how to deal with it and the path to it, etc. The whole thing is like a doctor. A doctor looks at you, decides what you've got, finds the underlying roots of it, and then shows you a way to do it, a way to solve your illness, which is exactly the same as what the Four Noble Truths does. But there is a problem. Because the word that is used, as close as we can know, the original word was dukkha. And this is the Pali word, which they have translated as suffering. But actually, it doesn't mean this. It's closer. A better translation would be struggle. So it originally comes, the word dukkha originally comes from the idea of a very bumpy ride on a cart. You're sitting in a cart pulled by a horse, and one of the wheels is not quite round. So you're going to get a very bumpy ride. So that's really what it means, which is very, very different to the emotional baggage of the word suffering.
Yeah.
These early translators who were very Christian, of course, suffering is a big thing in Christianity, you know, Christ on the cross and all the rest of it. So they put it into those words. But actually, the idea that there is suffering, if you say there is struggle, well, that's a very different thing. And the idea that the what causes us pain in this life is basically struggling to make things different than how they are. Well, that's very, very different to suffering, which sounds like some sort of Judeo-Christian idea that we're all born in sin and we all have to suffer and make ourselves better. So you see, you can quite easily see that just one mistranslation can have a vast effect on many, many people's lives.
Yeah.
This is just the tip of the iceberg. So when you get into a situation where you're translating, you are able to see these things very, very clearly when you rub up against the idea and that this doesn't exist in this particular language. And then you have to try to convey the meaning, which is the old argument, which will probably never be settled amongst translators. Who are you serving? Are you serving the author, or are you serving the meaning that the author wanted to get across? So if you as a translator start correcting things, because that's also one of the temptations of a translator, it's like, oh yeah, well, they obviously didn't mean this, they meant that. Now, now something else is happening. And if we get even further out and we go into poetry, poetry simply cannot be translated. So at that point, the translator becomes the poet. I mean, there's no way around this.
Yeah.
And we have plenty of examples of this. We even have, you know, in recent memory, I suppose, Samuel Beckett, who moved to France and started to write in French because he said he could not express what he wanted to express in English, even though he was born in Ireland. You know, so we have, you know, it's not just an Asian Western thing. It's also, once you deeply investigate what language is and how it shapes the world that you experience, then you realize that translation is actually fundamental to existence, because we're translating, you start to see it a little wider, we're actually translating from one medium into another all the time. We smell something and then we try to put that into words. We see something and then we try to capture that by writing something down. We have an experience and we try to convey that experience to somebody else. It's all a kind of translation. So when you are creating something like a record or a film or a book or something like that, what you can do and what I've tried to do for so long is to try and create a situation where that experience can happen of itself and not dictate to people, well, you're going to feel like this. This is, you know, you should follow these instructions. You create a situation by the various techniques and methods where something will happen, which you cannot predict, and you can't predict it anyway. So rather than try to dictate it, you just, like a good gardener, you plant the seeds. You don't know quite how the plants are going to come up, but you give it the right environment and it will come up. It will thrive. It will produce what it's supposed to produce. So these concerns, I mean, with preparing this and the translation and, you know, going through all of this sort of stuff, it really brought it home to me just how far and how lucky it is to be able to be in a situation to actually do this, and how valuable it is to go back and look at what you did, because it shows you another side of you. And you can extrapolate that and you can say, well, you know, just the very act of doing that in public shows people that the past is not fixed. That the past, when we remember something, we are creating the past. It doesn't exist like written down in stone on some, you know, or written on a hard disk even. It's malleable. We remember things the way that we want to remember them because of what we believe today. And not if we'd been asked 10 years before or 20 years or 30 years before, we would have seen it for ourselves in a different way. We would have explained our own behavior in different ways. We would have justified our behavior in different ways. And understanding that about the, if you like, the human condition is extremely important, that when people talk about their experiences, it's a product of what they believe today. They're not being objective, And they can't really be objective. To be objective would mean you'd have to stand outside your own life. And you can't do that. So yeah. Rather like the scientific method, which says, oh, well, we can be empirical about this. We can be objective about this. Well, of course you can't, because you're part of nature and you're looking at nature. And as modern science, I think, has recognized in some parts, when you look at something, you change it fundamentally. So yeah. Just the very act, it's, you know, it's the goldfish in the, it's the goldfish in the bowl thing. You don't know anything else and you can't experience anything except your own experience. It's all going to be filtered. It's all going to be altered by your life. The way, if I say the word dog to you, well, immediately you probably have a picture of a particular kind of dog. Now, I don't know what that dog is. I don't know whether it's a big dog, a small dog, whether you like dogs, whether you don't like dogs, whether you have an allergy to them. I don't know any of this sort of stuff. Now, it's bad enough when it's that, you know, it could be that different. It's bad enough. Like, what about when we're talking about something like politics or education or something like that? Yeah. Where you can't even point to it. You know, you can't actually say, oh, well, you can say, oh, look, there's a dog over there. And then we both understand that this label, this sound that we make, refers to that thing over there. But when you're talking about these abstract things, there's nothing to point to. And, you know, again, this is also something when, you know, when something becomes revealed to you that you've known for a very long time. So you can know something for years and years and years, and then you go, oh, that's what it means. And it can happen again and again and again if you allow it to, with the same piece of information or the same idea. You can re-understand it many times in one lifetime. And you go, oh, yeah, so it's also, and oh, no, you know, that kind of revelation is incredibly important. And by writing a text in the way that I've written it, you have, the attempt is to try and do that for other people. So that in the very act of having to create or recreate what is meant in the text, they have to do it for themselves. And it will, it will strongly encourage them to do that for their own processes. And to get a new perspective on something very often means you see it for the first time. And that's, you know, if that actually happens, then we have a wonderful situation.
Yeah, clearly. It is, you mentioned then that the first publication was then 30 years ago in this Ratio 3 book. The book you are now working on, the text you are now working on, are you rewriting this first version? Or will you give this first version, so to speak, in the book you are working on? The reader will have a look at the 1990s version, or will he have the brand new version? Are you rewriting what you already wrote?
I think there's only been 5 or 6 very tiny things that I've changed because they were simply wrong. Just grammatically wrong, or actually a mistyping in a couple of, where I actually typed the wrong word. Again, you know what it's like when you're trying to proofread something. You always miss a few things.
That's just
a fact. And they're generally the most obvious things. So, yeah, the original is there with a sort of commentary. Basically, the text is now talking to itself, you could say. So,
wow.
It's a very, as I said before, it's been a fascinating and still ongoing. I mean, a fascinating process actually doing this, and it will be. It's going to be at least double the length that it was, and it will be printed in a. It's a bit difficult to describe it in words how it'll be printed, but it'll be printed in an unorthodox way, shall we say? So it will be. It will be quite something to experience, I think. So it won't be a mass audience, I'm sure, but that's not really the point. But it will not be a book to read on the beach while sipping pina coladas, I don't think. So, or maybe it will. I don't know. I would love to get a postcard from somebody saying, "Yeah, I just read your book on the beach in Marbella with a couple of pina coladas," and yeah, that would be great. But I don't think it's going to happen. So.
Any knowledge of the timing?
Do you know? Well, there's a number of ways this can go. The actual production of the finishing of the text and the way that it's going to be printed requires that I set it out in a particular way, which is a little bit tricky. It's just tricky, not hard. But that should be finished. I don't know. I should imagine within the next month or something, maybe that should be done. And the question is how to actually put it out. We have talking about several models, the subscription model. I miscalculated how many pages it was going to be. So there was the idea to split it into three volumes, but it now looks like it might be possible to do it in one. How we actually put this, major publishers are not going to be interested. So I'm not even going to try to go down that road. The more open-minded publishers who I approached said, "Oh yeah, but can't you make, you have to make this into, you know, a logical sequence and, you know, you have to," unbelievably, you know, the people you would think would be the most open to experimentation are actually the least. And then you point out the sort of history of millions selling or more books, which are considered to be almost impossible to read or very difficult to read. And you realize that people underestimate just how intelligent people are. I mean, there are books, very, very popular books, which were rejected by just about every publisher under the sun and went on to sell millions and millions of copies. Books printed in very unorthodox fashions with non-linear narratives, totally wacko. And yet people, in a way, they took them as being puzzles which had to be solved. And that was the sort of fascination. And people love puzzles. So they took that, you know, and they were extremely successful. And there's a long list. I mean, in recent memory, I'm not even talking about people like Joyce or Beckett or whatever. Who are considered to, I mean, you know, Finnegan's Wake. Do you know anyone who has sat down and read Finnegan's Wake from beginning to end? You probably don't. And there are people who studied it for 30, 40 years and they still can't understand it. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that Joyce didn't even remember half of what he put in there. So I'm serious. And, you know, Beckett, most people, when they come across Beckett for the first time, can't believe that anybody would write like that. If you look at but then if we look at more modern times, when we look at this book House of Leaves, for example, which was considered to be just, you know, it's a great big, it's a big fat book, and it's not a linear story by any means. It sold millions and millions and millions of copies.
Trend, you know, I was in told you I was in New York City. It was on the main display, actually, in the Strand bookshop. Uh-huh. So it's a book that sells.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, so this people sort of say, "Oh yes, well, you have to put it into a normal narrative." It's just rubbish, you know. It's just absolute rubbish. I mean, you have to also, it's almost, again, it's almost a cliche, but it's really true that, I mean, Hildur, who won the Oscar yesterday or the day before for best soundtrack to this film, Joker, she plays cello on the Hafner Trio record, La Chanson Dada.
Yeah.
And so I've known her for a long time. I don't know her very well, but, at least 19, 20 years ago when I first met her. And there she is winning the Oscar for best soundtrack. Now, I can tell you, 30 years ago, nobody would have thought about putting a soundtrack like that on a film which was going to be seen by millions and millions of people. It's just too weird. So all the stuff, you know, all these literary experiments which were you know, the cut-ups. I mean, all you have to do is look at any modern film. It's all cut-ups, all of it. You know, people flash from one scene to another scene, and it's backwards and forwards in time, and you know, it has nothing to do with the previous scene and all that. You can't see a film like that from the 1950s. You know, people didn't make it because nobody would have watched it. So all these weird, so-called weird ideas, a lot of people haven't caught on to the fact that they're actually mainstream now. Cut-ups are everywhere. MTV showed that very, very clearly. The attention span of people considerably diminished by the idea that you can't show anybody anything for more than a couple of seconds, otherwise they won't look at it. They'll look at something else. So, so when we get this all sorted out with it, it should be possible to actually get it out, I think, in the middle of this year. I'm not sure that's a good whether that's a good time for publishing anything. There are different times of year which are good and some which are not so good. But yeah, it's definitely on track for in the next few months, I would say. So, and it should. I mean, obviously, people, you know, who know the other stuff to do with the sound material, obviously that would be of interest to them. But this book, you don't need to. I mean, anybody could pick this book up, and they don't need to have any background about me or what I've done in the past at all.
No. Okay,
it's independent of all of that. So,
is there a place that people could get update of the process? Your website, the Simply Superior website,
simplysuperior.org. That's Simply Superior, as in one word. And there will be, in the next week or so, there will be something up there, some sort of text and a little bit of video and. Some first sort of looks at how the pages are going to be presented and all this other kind of stuff. I can't say exactly when because, how long is it going to spring? But within the next couple of weeks, yes.
Great.
All right.
Okay.
I think that's it, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah.
All right. Very good.